Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the director of the FBI's announcement that Hillary Clinton had not broken the law by using a private email server, stating that no prosecutor would want to pursue charges in this matter. Frances Kissling, the former president of Catholics for Choice, who serves on the advisory board of the Journal of Feminist Ethics, joins us to discuss the extent to which the decades-long project of Republican plutocrats and their hired character assassins to tar the Clintons with scandal, whether it is real or not, has succeeded in creating a public perception that the Democratic candidate for president is untrustworthy. We will also explore whether the taint of scandal surrounding Hillary Clinton will be lifted by today's announcement and why the excitement at the possibility of America having its first female leader seems to have fallen flat. Then, following the FBI's director's rebuke that Hillary Clinton was careless with her use of an email server, we will look into how careless Donald Trump has been in tweeting an image of Hillary Clinton in front of raining money and a Star of David, which is widely seen as an anti-Semitic image that Trump quickly took down and replaced with a circle and a new hashtag, America First, another careless reference to the movement founded by the pro-Hitler white supremacist Charles Lindbergh. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, who previously served as associate director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force, joins us to discuss the repetitive nature of Donald Trump's accidental misstatements, which he disavows, but which excite and mobilize the white supremacist community. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, about the three suicide bombings in Saudi Arabia which have been linked to the self-declared Islamic State. We will discuss the direct challenge that these terrorist acts pose to the ruling family's role as custodians of the holy shrines of Islam. And since one of the bombers was from Pakistan, the growing discontent within the expatriate community, who are essentially the kingdom's slaves without rights, but make up more than one-third of the country's population. And joining us now is Frances Kissling, who's president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy and the former president of Catholics for Choice. She's a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. And she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Hi, Ian. Great to be with you.
And what's your sense of whether or not the director of the FBI, James Comey's press conference today, where he spent most of the press conference rebuking Hillary Clinton for her use of this email and for being careless, but then at the end of it said that this is there's nothing here. She really didn't break the law. This is nothing that a prosecutor would want to bring, and I'm recommending that we don't prosecute. And of course, she and Barack Obama hit the campaign trail and down in North Carolina campaigning together. So it looks as if she's hit the ground running. But what do you think of the residual lasting effect of today's announcement will be?
Well, I think, first of all, I do think that the decision pretty much mirrors what we've been hearing from mainstream press over the 16-month period, and that is some real dissatisfaction with, what was described as carelessness and perhaps kind of a cavalier attitude towards, confidentiality and security at the State Department and by Secretary Clinton, but that she did in fact commit no crime. So I think that within the mainstream, this pretty much, as I say, mirrors the viewpoint. On the other hand, I think that that it will continue to, unfortunately, it will continue to have some lasting, will do some lasting damage To the secretary, and in effect, the reason for that is that it does mirror mainstream opinion, and that the secretary, while she has said, Mrs. Clinton, while she has said that she it was a mistake to do this, and that she would, you know, never do it again, and she had to do it over, she would do it over. She also has not been in the minds of both some of her supporters and. More neutral observers, has been less than fully frank in her comments about this. Things like, this was allowed, this was permitted, that there are many things that she, there are a number of things that she has not answered. And so I think that we will continue to see the characterization of her as, at a minimum, as less than fully forthright. Again, a kind of arrogance in even in apology, even in saying something was wrong, is going to prevail and is going to plague her throughout the rest of the campaign and the electoral season.
Well, it does seem, and as I mentioned in the opening, that there's no question that when Hillary Clinton, back in her, during her husband's presidency, talked about the vast right-wing conspiracy, even though that was widely ridiculed, it was actually quite accurate that, that a jaundiced plutocrat, Richard Mellenscape, had basically formed a whole operation to find dirt on the Clintons, and they didn't care whether it stuck or not. They were just relentless. And lo and behold, Bill Clinton finally hands them a gift with Monica Lewinsky. And, one wonders whether or not this, after all this Benghazi nonsense, which went nowhere, whether Hillary Clinton handed them a gift with this server business. But now, at least in legal terms, that's been put to rest.
But that's important.
Yeah.
That's definitely important. You know, and I think that you know, we are in such extreme and unusual political times where there's so much that is shocking all of us with Donald Trump, with the kind of support he has had from Republicans, with the anger, too much support from Republicans, with the obvious anger of a segment of American society that is supporting Trump, that in some senses all bets are off. About rationality, practicality, in the political season. So while I certainly don't think it is fair that Hillary Clinton continues to be attacked by Trump and that this very conservative right-wing attack on her and on her husband continues. It's not a fair attack. I think that it does have an effect on more people than those of us who are liberal or progressive or Democrats are happy about.
And again, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who's president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy, and a former president of Catholics for Choice, a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project, and she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org. So I think it's fair to say that Hillary Clinton is extremely lucky to be running against Donald Trump. In one day, he says more outrageous things than she said or done in her entire lifetime. The attack machine makes sure we never forget anything that she does, whether it's real or imaginary. For some reason or other, Donald Trump's sins, as often and frequent as they are, seem to be ephemeral. I wanted to zero in on why it is that, it took luck for her to be where she is and the fact that she's likely to end up in the White House, as opposed to the fact that she's a highly qualified candidate, yet somehow she's not clicking. She's not even clicking with young women, and you're a lifelong feminist, and I'm sure you have some puzzlement about this. So let's begin with that. Why has this idea of the possibility of America's first female president appear to have fallen flat? It's not given her a boost, and even within the ranks of women, there's some hostility and lack of support.
Well, I think that, first of all, we do have to acknowledge that there is – I mean, I certainly hear it all the time from women that I know, lots of women and women that I encounter, that they are excited by the fact of the first woman president. But there also is, but I don't disagree with you that there is some falling flats, among younger women and perhaps among some other women. It's kind of like, oh well, you know, so what? You know, it's not important that they're the first woman. And I think that this reflects somewhat some kind of changes that have occurred in American society, where we do, as feminists, we do look at qualifications more than we look at gender. In other words, it's not the most important thing that Hillary Clinton is a woman. The most important thing is, as you say, that Hillary Clinton is a highly qualified candidate. Now, she's not getting credit for being highly qualified. This, of course, really does go back to the whole entire Clinton administration. The kind of hatred that we are seeing now, that we have seen in the past years towards Obama and the Obama family, a vicious, vicious, racist kind of hatred towards them, is really not that dissimilar to the hatred that both Hillary and Bill received. I mean, we remember that it was Toni Morrison, I believe, who said that Bill Clinton was the first black president. That there is something about progressives, you know, and you know, yes, in many ways the Clintons are centrists, but to most of America, to you know, the average American, they're kind of more you know, seen as more progressive, and I think that hatred cannot be discounted, and that hatred spills over into people who themselves don't feel the hatred, but that become, you know, that are not so highly enchanted with them. I also think, and I'm actually speaking for myself as well, although I do certainly support Hillary Clinton in this campaign, I think that when people become very rich, as the Clintons have, that it becomes harder for a segment of the progressive community to really feel fully supportive. That, you know, that sense of privilege that surrounds the Clintons is not attractive.
Well, but in this long introduction by the FBI director today, James Comey, in laying out the case against Hillary Clinton, and then by ending up saying, but there really is no case, at least none, that could be prosecuted under the law. Right. He did talk about the reckless use of these servers, not just one but several, and also the fact that they were sort of cherry picking a lot of the international contacts as Secretary of State, and handing them over to the Clinton Foundation. So I think a lot of the objections that people have, not so much about the Clintons being rich, but the way in which they got rich, which Bernie Sanders certainly seized on, that yeah. She got $250,000 for a speech at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I think that those are very valid concerns to be raised. They're disturbing even to a number of Democratic supporters who still result in saying that, you know, this is a highly qualified woman. But, you know, she just doesn't get much credit for that part of her record. And you know, you just can't dismiss the power of such a continuous attacks and continuous statements. And you know, there is, the Clintons are and behave as highly privileged people within our society. The things that you are pointing to are part of that behavior of people of privilege, whether it's the foundation, whether it's, Clinton's relationships with Wall Street, the speeches, Clinton saying things like, you know, well, when we left the White House, we were dirt poor, and I had to do this kind of thing. I mean, you know, these are troubling remarks, and I think she pays for them.
Well, just in the last minute or so, then, Frances Kissling, what's your understanding of why young women? I know we talked about it a little bit. I want to get an understanding of why young women don't see her as being significant, and two, How is she going to win over this electorate, not just having to rely on Donald Trump self-destructing, but really, you know, come up with some kind of way? Because everybody that knows her personally says she's actually a lot of fun to be with. She's sort of lighthearted and likes to dance around and get loose and
is very kind and generous.
Right, but why? But she's a total stiff
her.
Though. On the campaign trail, she's a
Absolutely.
Total stiff.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, I think that you're hitting the nail on the head in the sense that, you know, she doesn't come across as someone that younger women can relate well to. I mean, those of us who are older, who have known her for a long time, who have enough of a history, you know, in which many of the women who are working on her campaigns, the older ones, you know, knew her when she worked at the Children's Defense Fund, knew her when she was engaged in more directly in attempting to make life better for people. And so that it's easier for them to connect with her. But, you know, younger women, women in their 20s, say, and you know, there are plenty of them who are very supportive of her, but the ones who are sort of like, eh, you know, I'm not impressed, are seeing that hard-shelled, uncomfortable, kind of boxy, older woman. And it just doesn't sit well with them. Now, how is she going to do anything about that is really a question that if I had the answer to, I would be, you know, working, I would be making lots of money working on her campaign, I guess. But I think that it's going to be very, very hard for her to overcome that. What I would hope to some extent is that the demise of some of these charges, whether it was the Benghazi stuff, which has now, you know, also, you know, for the final time, the Congress couldn't find anything wrong with her, whether it was the dismissal of the email issue, although the right will continue to point to the fact that she was found to be negligent in dealing with her email system.
Careless, actually, that was the word.
Careless, yes. I mean, it was actually quite indicting. It was really...
No, but that's... I'd say careless is less than negligent, but anyway, let's not split hairs.
we don't have to quibble over that. Right. And I think that perhaps with the resolution of those issues, she may get more of a chance to get out. She herself may relax a little bit. She certainly has to get off the defensive, because when she speaks defensively, she doesn't sound genuine. You know, that's what happens. So it's like, well, I was allowed to do this. I mean, even the advertisement which compares the way in which she spoke about the email server with the way in which Bill Clinton spoke about Lewinsky, the Lewinsky business, you know, it doesn't make her look good. She doesn't do well when she is on the defensive. So I think the biggest thing for her is really to get into, you know, to put herself in a space where she does not defend herself, and that she really begins to really focus almost exclusively on what she can do for the country and what she believes. She's not, you know, she's not as great as she needs to be in terms of projecting her vision, and in the sense of with young women, really dealing with her vision for women in America. She's out there. She's definitely out there, but somehow she's not really projecting that.
Well, Frances Kissling, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Frances Kissling, who's the president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy and the former president of Catholics for Choice. She's a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. And she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for religiondispatches.org. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Donald Trump's careless anti-Semitism, which apparently excites some of his followers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues, and previously served as the director of legal affairs for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City police officer and has recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, and a longtime fan of yours.
Oh, well, thank you, Brian. Now, let's turn to Donald Trump, who many of my listeners say, why do I keep talking about this guy? But he is the Republican nominee of the Republican Party. He's the nominee, and he's in 2 weeks' time, he'll be there'll be a coronation in Cleveland, but they may well be surrounded by white supremacists with assault rifles. So it's going to be an interesting in a couple of weeks' time. But how do you explain? Of course, I try to make the point in the introduction, Brian, that today the FBI director rebuked Hillary Clinton for the careless, in quote, use of her email server. But Donald Trump has been careless in tweeting images of Hillary Clinton in front of raining money with a Star of David, clearly an anti-Semitic image. He quickly took it down and replaced it with a circle and a new hashtag, America First, which is another careless reference to the movement founded by the pro-Hitler white supremacist Charles Lindbergh. So what you have here is a pattern, repetitive nature of Donald Trump's accidental misstatements, but every time he disavows what he's just done, curiously enough, he excites and mobilizes the white supremacist community. So is this by accident or by design?
Well, it could be a little of both. Not being a mind reader, what I'm left with is what is being done and what are the results. And what is so uncanny, and let me again make this proviso, our center is nonpartisan. 4 years ago on Hardball, Chris Matthews asked me who the extremists root for, and I said they don't. And he mentioned various Republicans, and I said they don't. They consider them all sellouts. This election year, it's different. There is a virtual who's who of the white nationalist and white supremacist community that has lionized and embraced Trump in a way that I have not seen. And I'm talking about David Duke, the leadership of Stormfront, for instance, which was founded by a former federal felon who was a Klansman. The Daily Stormers, Andrew Anglin, Matt Heimbach of the Traditionalist Workers Party, Klan folks, including one that I ran into at a rally, who have just been unanimous in their praise. And it goes across the spectrum, including the so-called intellectual part of the quote, alt-right movement, like American Renaissance, as well. I haven't seen anything like that. So the issue is, when he sends out a tweet which had imagery which came from folks who were anti-Semites, and shows an image of the Star of David as a solid figure in the way that the Nazis used a yellow star, or when he retweeted back in November crime statistics, which falsely said, and by the way, this particular tweet that was retweeted started out on a white supremacist site, which falsely said that whites killed by blacks, 81%. That's completely fallacious. So when we couple that with what even Paul Ryan has criticized as bigotry, we have to wonder what is going on. Because when we're talking about policy, just let me close on this, and I'll take whatever question you have. There's nothing wrong in the political mainstream to discuss controversial issues like national security, like immigration. The problem here is when we have an electorate that includes a segment that is very anxious and concerned, and some of whom do not have great factual data, the use of incorrect information, conspiracy theories, and lastly, bigotry, which labels certain people as unfit in civic participation in the United States, whether you're a federal judge of Mexican-American heritage, or if you're a Muslim person, Islam hates us, and talking about mass bans of Muslim people coming to the United States, all this imagery and symbolism, even when it's at times walked back, is viewed as, I think as Van Jones said, a wink and a nod to those who are at the most extreme end of this. So this populism ensnares people who are legitimate people of goodwill who are concerned about the direction of the country. But when it's intertwined with this bigotry, it's very difficult. And I think we have to ask, why is there such unanimity in support of Mr. Trump from hate groups? The last thing I want to do is discuss mainstream politics during a political season. That's for other pundits. But when folks who I monitor as the worst of extremists come out unabashedly for Mr. Trump, they're going to provide security for Trump supporters at the Republican convention, or they manhandle African-American female protesters at rallies. This is a problem.
Well, I read this interesting note to an employee of the New York Observer, which is a newspaper owned by Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And so the letter is from Dana Schwartz, who works for The Observer, to her boss, basically, you know, castigating him and holding him responsible for these anti-Semitic images, which he's tried to disavow. And what's extraordinary about this piece by her is the inclusion that she has of the tweets that she's gotten. And there are literally hundreds of them. You can go through them all. And they're the most poisonous anti-Semitic tweets. So there's an awful lot of people out there that really support the worst, at least they cling to the worst of what Donald Trump accidentally says.
And you know, a credit to the Observer for printing the response from Ms. Schwartz, and again, you know, this might be tied into something else, because if you look back and look at some of Mr. Trump's comments over the years, whether it's with regard to abortion or the LGBT community, it's been much more moderate. But I think what he has found is this intemperate tone actually appeals to people who feel that no one has stood up for them. So that perhaps if he walked back things a little better, and really disavowed, not like he's being forced to disavow this adulation coming from the white nationalist community, what would happen? Would that make him seem inauthentic? And, you know, he's someone who never likes to admit he's wrong. But the bottom line here, forgetting about Mr. Trump, we don't endorse candidates or anything like that. What I think has happened is the sheet music that existed within the white nationalist and white supremacist world, which did not get a full airing in mainstream politics, it was always kind of dog whistle, has now been sung in the mainstream political arena. And what I think that has accomplished has been the green lighting of white nationalists and white supremacists and anti-Semites like Matt Heimbach, who is a vigorous supporter of Mr. Trump, an anti-Semite, a Holocaust denier, to come out of the woodwork. And that is going to be a terrible side effect from this no-holds-barred manner of campaigning, which includes bigotry and kind of an acceptance or tolerance for violence. And what that has also done, by the way, is it reverberated across to the hard left, which said, hey, we gotta, you know, we gotta bash heads too. So this has been just a terrible development. Even if we play the devil's advocate and say that Mr. Trump is using this more for political expediency than for ideological reasons, the effect is that to different parts of his constituency, going from those who are susceptible to bigotry because of their anxiety and fear, all the way to folks who are trying to exploit something that the white nationalist world hasn't had in years, and that is a charismatic celebrity who gets the message out. And that's troubling. So I'm trying to say that forgetting about what you think of the campaign and individual candidates, this has had a deleterious effect on socio-civic discourse in the United States because it's green-lighted a kind of bigotry that has overtaken the policy discussions. We're not talking about national security or immigration in a way that's not tainted by bigotry. And that's problematic, and I think it's going to be problematic for the Republican Party, where there are many legitimate people of goodwill who have conservative positions on things, like Paul Ryan, but eschew bigotry. This is a problem. It's green-lighted bigotry.
Well, I noticed that Corey Lewandowski, his Trump's former campaign manager, who's now with CNN, believe it or not, he has dismissed it all as political correctness run amok. But if you read the tweets that the woman from the Observer, the New York Observer, got in response to her rebuke of her boss, who's Trump's son-in-law, who is the apparently the one of the few people that he actually listens to. And, of course, he's the liaison to Rupert Murdoch at Fox, by the way, this young Kushner, Jared Kushner. If you read her, watch what these people, these poisonous outpourings from these anti-Semites and white nationalists. You know, when you hear what Lewandowski has to say, that's pretty pale, and it does not. You cannot dismiss what this woman received as you know, somehow excessive political correctness. You know, you're right. It's covering up the ugly, and it's pretty clear to me that you can't dismiss the ugly tweet she got as some sort of political correctness gone mad or run amok.
To a certain extent, though, if you look at the Edison exit polling done, for instance, Super Tuesday, these kinds of proposals with regard to deporting all undocumented people or banning Muslims actually has political currency now, where the plurality of Americans may actually favor, depending on what polls you look at, favor this temporary ban on Muslims, which is a horrible idea, not only morally, but from a national security standpoint as well. But the bottom line is, in a certain segment of the electorate, this kind of rhetoric and symbology sells. And what I worry about is that not that we can't have discussions about immigration or a whole variety of things, but when policies take a back seat to hitting at the emotion of exploiting people's fears and concerns, many of whom, you know, do not rely on data, but their feelings, this has created a situation, unfortunately, where the white nationalist and white supremacist community is now active with regard to mainstream politics and are endorsing a mainstream candidate in a way that I haven't seen in decades.
Well, as I say, you know, and you said it earlier, this has become an excuse to sanction racism, and attacking political correctness is a form of saying, you know, we've already got permission to be racist, and you can't pull us over. But again, you know, he's bringing out this poison, and he can't disavow it forever. It's quite shocking, and I recommend people read these tweets to get an idea of what's lurking out there. And just in closing, do you think there's enough of people like that lurking out there in the woodwork that are likely to swing the election for Donald Trump?
You know, here's what I think. I don't know. It's a relatively small number. Here's the problem. These messages, which were heretofore segregated into the extreme, in other words, whatever your position on policy, there was something where the Republican Party wasn't going to tolerate certain overt statements of bigotry, as John McCain demonstrated when he was running for office. Now we're having similar statements come up at town halls, and the response is, yeah, I agree, or we'll look into this. I share your concern. Instead of saying, look, I understand that these are difficult times, but pluralism is what America is about. And I think if there's a problem, is that there will be mainstream voters that won't, they're not going to join the Klan. But what they will do, I think, is revert back to a rejection of the pluralism that defines one of the foundations of America. And that's scary, and that very well could turn an election.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Brian Levin.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, he served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and was also a New York City police officer, and has recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the coordinated 3 bombings in Saudi Arabia, apparently by the Islamic State.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody want to tell it like it is? Like you would to a sister or a brother. It could be said, cosmopolitan style.
اكتب وخطب القلم بالقلم اكتب وخطب القلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس ما لي حدا يا ناس ما لي حدا بهمي يواسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
In this bombing that took place, 3 bombings in different parts of Saudi Arabia, one near the Prophet's tomb, the burial site of the Prophet Muhammad, that's in the western city of Medina, another near a Shiite mosque in the eastern city of Qatif, and then another at the U.S. consulate in the western city of Jeddah. This obviously is coordinated attacks, and in particularly the attack on the Prophet's tomb, where 4 security guards died, that would seem to be a direct challenge to the al-Saud family from the Islamic State, basically challenging their authority as custodians of the holy shrines. I mean, it seems pretty brazen and pretty obvious, isn't it?
That's true, and it could be also. There are many people who don't like the Saudi regime, not necessarily the religious groups and ISIS and al-Qaeda, but there are others like people from Yemen since the invasion of Yemen, people from Bahrain since the Saudi invasion of Bahrain, and you have liberals and you have women, you have many, many people, but looks like this coordinated 3 attacks in 24 hours might be from the ISIS groups whose primary objective is to actually replace the House of Saud as the representative of the Muslims and the custodian of the holy Muslim shrines in Saudi Arabia. And you are right. Their goal is to discredit the Saudi regime and to prove that the Saudi royal family, despite their extraordinary expenditures on security, are incapable of protecting their citizens, the Muslims, millions of Muslims who visit Saudi Arabia every year through the year. And it is a very, very big, ominous problem for the Saudi regime, and it's for allies in the West, businesses and governments.
But it would seem that this ubiquitous security system with various layers of police forces and paramilitary forces in Saudi Arabia, to some extent, did limit the damage. Four security officers died near the Prophet's tomb. Several were wounded. And in Qatif and in Jeddah, the suicide bombers blew themselves up because security people had them surrounded. So to that extent, you could make the case that even though the signal was sent by ISIS, nevertheless, it does seem that Saudi security was on the ball.
Well, there's no question that, you know, Saudi Arabia is a police state long before ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but since the creation of these groups, it has definitely multiplied many times over, especially now. But it's, and I'm glad, I'm glad they did not succeed in getting into the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, because there were thousands and thousands of people praying, ending the month of Ramadan. And the outcome, had they made it inside the mosque, would have been catastrophic. So it is good that the securities or security apparatus were there. But, you know, Saudi Arabia is a huge country. It's a vast country, and it's only a matter of time. I hope I'm wrong here, because I didn't like death and destruction. It's only a matter of time before they inflict a huge damage to the Saudi people and to the expatriate people and to the regime itself. Killers find their ways when they want to. Look what happened to the West, like France and Belgium and the United States and other places, Bangladesh, everywhere. It's a very big problem. This ideology, based in Wahhabism, and the extremists that are carrying it out all over the world, is a very, very big problem, not only for the people of the Muslim world, but for the international community and as a whole.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a native of Saudi Arabia. He's lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Of course, Saudi Arabia is a signatory to the Jeddah Communique, which is an international agreement to combat Daesh, the Islamic State, and in general radical extremism, which would include Al-Qaeda as well. And they signed this agreement to cut off funding, block foreign fighters, and repudiate the ideology of extremism, which you just pointed out is Wahhabism. And apparently the Saudis have done nothing about the last part of the Jeddah communique, when the Saudi information minister shut down a television channel, Wesal, in 2014, because they were inciting death against the Shiites. The information minister was fired by then King Abdullah. And then when Saad bin Atish al-Atish, a Saudi preacher at the state-controlled mosque in 2015, urged his followers to destroy all Jews, Christians, Alawites, and Shiites, nothing happened to him. So what does that tell you?
Well, signing agreements, you know, the Saudis are signatory to the International Declaration on Human Rights and on the World Trade Organization, WTO, And that's only ink and papers. There is no, you could sign anything you want, and unless there is a repercussion if you break what you sign, then it doesn't mean anything. So that you know, signing agreements and documentation and declaration is of no use unless the people who sign it are held accountable and responsible to comply with what they sign on. And the Saudis have been sort of limits in terms of holding them accountable. And this is due mostly to the Western democracies' support for the Saudi regime because it has oil and money. And now the Saudis could use terrorism and extremism as a tool, like as they have done, actually, in 2006 when Prince Bandar, the Saudi former ambassador to the U.S., flew to Britain and told Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, that if the British are going to investigate a corruption trail of the British arms sales to the Saudis and billions of kickbacks for the Saudi regime from what they are supposed to pay to the British military manufacturers, he told them, this is documented, if you let the British judicial system continue with this investigation, we are not going to tell you when terrorists are going to attack you. So they are using this, the Saudis are using terrorism actually to blackmail other people as well. In terms of the Saudi at this point, the Saudi regime is more vulnerable than ever at any time in its history, both politically, financially, and everything else. I think the West has a very good, the West is in a very good position, especially the U.S., to press the Saudis to eradicate the root causes of terrorism and extremism, which is the Saudi doctrine, as abundantly documented over the years. And I think the Saudis are in a position also to comply with some of the international community demands because it is vulnerable. Its influence is declining because of the oil prices declining and other governments and other people are finding other sources of energy. So the West can play a major role in correcting this situation, not for the love of God, but actually to defend and protect their own citizens and their democratic values, which is the, you know, the Western civilization, the Western democracies are actually the target of these terrorist groups, extremists, and also of the Muslim, some of the Muslim regimes that the West is protecting. And so it's ironic that these things are happening and nothing is being done nothing has actually been done effectively. And unless something is done on time, things could get really bad for the Middle East and for the international community.
Well, it would seem that on top of the fact that Daesh, the Islamic State, is challenging the Al Saud family's legitimacy to be the custodians of the holy shrines, they also, with the attack or the attempted attack on the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, aren't they also trying to say that the Saudi regime is in bed with the infidels?
Exactly. That has been one of, you see, Daesh and Al-Qaeda and all of these groups, their main objective is to rule and to take charge of Muslim lands, and especially Mecca and Medina. But they also look for targets that will help them get more recruits, because there are many people in Saudi Arabia and other places who hold the United States accountable for many different things. One is there is a group of Saudis who blame the United States for supporting a system that is oppressing them. This includes especially liberals and women. And there is the other group who blame the Americans in the West for being the crusaders invading Muslim countries and destroy Muslim, try to destroy Islam, which I don't know how do you How do you destroy something you cannot see, feel, or touch? So there are many issues. Part of it is, as you said, they consider the Saudis are puppets of the West, and they have been. There is no question about that. The Saudis have been allying themselves with the West because they need Western powers to protect them from internal and external threats, and that has been done over the decades for the last 100 years. So the U.S. and the West in general are being blamed by different peoples for different reasons, both in Saudi Arabia and through the Middle East.
Well, what's the situation, though, with this vast population within Saudi Arabia who do all of the work, you know, domestic work? And for the person who was killed, tried to blow up the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, he's been identified as a Pakistani, Abdullah Khalzar Khan. He worked as a private driver in Jeddah for 12 years. So isn't there a very large population?
10 million people.
How many?
10 million people.
10 million.
10 million expatriates.
Out of a population of, what, 25 million?
Yeah, they are more than one-third of the Saudi population, yes.
Right. So is that also a potential area for, because they're not well treated, are they? They have no rights.
That's a huge problem that is going to blow up, and they have actually shown in recent years their disenchantment with the Saudi treatment of these expatriates. It is the way that expatriates, especially the poor laborers from, you know, Bangladesh and Pakistan and the Philippines and many other places, Sri Lanka and now Vietnam. These people have been treated abominably. They have no rights. They didn't get paid. They are abused physically, mentally, emotionally, and sexually. And nobody helps them, including their own homeland governments, because most of their governments are recipients of the Saudi largesse. That group, and this is a good example you just gave, this man who has been working in Saudi Arabia for 12 years as a driver who probably works 24 hours. When you are a driver, you sleep in your car or in the back of people's homes, so you are on call 24 hours a day since you are a driver. So they have been abused, and this is a big problem that might explode in the Saudi government faces. Because most of these people, all of the laborers, you have different kinds of expatriates. You have the technocrats, you have the professionals, but the overwhelming majority are laborers, poor people. And those are the ones, and they are Muslims, Christians, and many others. And that could cause a major problem for the regime, actually.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, it's obvious that Daesh, the Islamic State, is under attack, and it's losing territory and losing men, fighters, at a pretty alarming rate for them, in that they're resorting to more and more to asymmetrical warfare, using terrorism, such as the attack on the airport in Istanbul. Are they likely then to turn their attention, now that they're being pushed out of Iraq, are they likely to turn their attention on Saudi Arabia and send in more?
They will. Of course they will. First of all, their main objective from the outset, maybe not exactly the outset, but has been to be the true representatives of real Islam. And Mecca and Medina is their target, for example, because if you rule those two holy places, then you control Islam and Muslims. So now ISIS is being chased from parts of Iraq and Syria, which they have been focusing on. Their focus has been fighting the Shiite populations in those countries and their Shiite regimes in those countries, and leaving Saudi Arabia for later. If they, as time goes by and they get weakened in Iraq and Syria and other places, I can guarantee you they will turn their brunt on the Saudi regime and Saudi Arabia. So you are going to see, a lot of unpleasant, unfortunately, unpleasant events in Saudi Arabia that will ensue, based on what these groups are saying. That's what they want to do. They want to be the retro Khalifat of Islam that represents Salafi Islam and rule the Muslim world according to their own belief or their own doctrine.
Well, just in closing, it seems that Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, who's been absent from the scene, there are rumors that he was ill, he did show up at a hospital bed just in the last minute. What's your understanding of the latest palace intrigue where the young king is getting increasingly unpopular, the young deputy crown prince, the younger son of the current king?
Well, you know, the palace politics is very intriguing, and it is very secret, and they didn't tell you, you didn't really know what's going on, including some of the princes themselves. But the young prince Mohammed bin Salman has been empowered. You know, he is the defense minister, he is the overseer of the Saudi economic reforms, and he has so much power, and he's the third in line for power. He's young, he's inexperienced, he's very much like his father, extremist in terms of his political and religious views. And most of the other princes have been excluded. The only three people you see in the pictures now is King Salman, his son, and his nephew. In the past, it used to be the three pictures. It used to be the king, the crown prince, and the founder of the country. That has gone. So Prince Mohammed is definitely ambitious, and his father wants him to rule. You have to understand that King Salman is the most, he's the most ardent believer that Saudi Arabia belongs to the Saudi ruling family. And his son Mohammed was chosen because he shared those views. In fact, the Prince Mohammed, the king's son, is the only minister or prince of any significance who decided to live in Diriyah, which is the first capital city of the Saudi Wahhabis in the desert. So Prince Mohammed will not be king soon because he doesn't have the experience, he doesn't have the popularity, and there are many princes who don't want him to be king. So what he's going to do, he's going to continue doing what he's doing. His father is ill, and it's a matter of time before he disappears from the political scene and power scene. So what Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the king's son, will do is continue to support Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who is the crown prince, to become the next king until this other guy establishes himself among the people and also the international community as a fit to rule. So this is the trend that's going on in the country. But Mohammed bin Nayef definitely will be the next king, given unless drastic measures are taken, given what I just told you.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you, sir.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he's advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.